Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
It is. It's so great to be back here with you to unpack another really fascinating text.
Yeah, and if you, like, ate a slice of bread today, or maybe you had an apple with your breakfast, you've actually already interacted with one of the most volatile, high-tech, and honestly fragile economic webs on the planet.
You really have. It's wild to think about.
Right. And in our last deep dive, we were looking at Article 05, exploring the power of music. So we were way over in the realm of the arts, the humanities, talking about emotional resonance and cultural history.
Which was a very abstract, theoretical discussion, you know? But the thing is, the TOEFL exam really demands cognitive flexibility.
Oh, totally.
You have to be able to jump from the concert hall to the science lab without missing a beat.
And today, for Article 06, we are making exactly that kind of pivot. We're putting away the art history books, and we're putting on our work boots.
Let's do it.
But we aren't just stepping into some simple, old-fashioned farm field. We are stepping into a field with, like, a satellite uplink in one hand and a complex economic spreadsheet in the other.
Right, because we are exploring the intense, high-stakes world of agricultural economics.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this is a really dense C1-level academic passage.
It really is. It covers modern farming, globalization, and that massive friction between human survival and environmental preservation.
Which is a huge topic.
Exactly. And our goal today isn't to just, you know, hand you a boring list of vocabulary words to memorize. Rote memorization rarely works when you're under the pressure of an exam.
Yeah, you just blank out.
Right. Instead, we're going to translate these high-level academic concepts into clear B1, B2 friendly explanations.
We're going to explore the hidden mechanisms, the roots, the affixes, and the real-world scenarios that will make these words unforgettable.
So by the time we finish this deep dive, you will be fully prepared for any TOEFL reading passage that touches on these themes.
Let's start by just getting our bearings.
Yeah.
When a TOEFL passage introduces a discipline like agricultural economics, it can sound pretty intimidating.
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
Like, most people understand agriculture, farming, growing things, and they understand economics, money, markets, trade.
Yeah.
But bringing them together creates this very specific academic field. What exactly are we looking at here?
Well, at its core, agricultural economics is the study of how society allocates its resources to feed itself.
Okay.
Because, I mean, we only have a finite amount of land. We only have a finite amount of fresh water.
Right. It's not endless.
Exactly. We have a certain amount of human labor, a certain amount of capital or money. So how do we mix those limited ingredients together to produce enough food for 8 billion people?
8 billion. That's a lot of mouths to feed.
It is. And then how do we distribute that food globally? It's essentially the marriage of biology and finance.
I like that. Biology and finance.
Yeah, and our source text today builds an argument around four core pillars of this discipline. First, the rise of high-tech precision farming. Second, the opposing rise of natural organic farming. Third, the massive web of global trade. And finally, a reality check on the severe challenges that threaten all of those systems.
So we've got this massive system, but the text doesn't describe a static, unchanging world.
Right.
Right in the opening sentence, it presents a catalyst.
Right.
It says that agricultural economics has undergone significant changes, and it points to two specific drivers for these changes, technology and consumer demand. Let's look at the language there. To undergo is a fantastic B2-level verb.
It really is. Undergo means to experience something, specifically a process of change, or sometimes something difficult, like a patient might undergo surgery.
Or a caterpillar undergoes metamorphosis.
Exactly. In this case, the entire farming industry is undergoing a massive transformation. I mean, it is not the same industry it was 50 years ago.
It's kind of like upgrading from a basic flip phone to a modern smartphone, right? It's no longer just a person driving a dusty tractor. It's this high-tech, data-driven industry responding to what people want at the grocery store.
That is a perfect analogy.
And the text says these changes are driven by advancements in technology and shifts in consumer demand. I want to pause on those two nouns for a second. Advancements and shifts. They seem simple, but they carry specific academic weight.
They definitely do. Let's start with advancement. The root verb here is advance, which comes from old French and Latin roots, meaning to move forward or to move higher.
Advance, right.
Yeah, when you advance, you're making progress, but when we add the noun suffix explainment, we turn that action into a state or a process. So an advancement is a specific step forward. It usually implies an improvement.
You see this constantly in TOEFL passages. You'll read about an advancement in medical research or like an advancement in renewable energy. It tells you that the field has achieved something new and better.
Exactly. But the second driver of change is described a bit differently. The text points to shifts in consumer demand.
A shift.
Yeah. Shift is a highly useful word in academic English because it implies a very specific type of movement. It isn't necessarily a straight line forward like an advancement.
Right.
A shift is a change in position, direction, or tendency.
Like shifting your weight from your left foot to your right foot. You haven't necessarily moved forward. You've just, you know, changed your balance.
Yes, exactly.
Or think about the shift key on your computer keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
When you press it, it changes the state of the letters from lowercase to uppercase. It changes the condition of things.
That is a brilliant way to look at it. So in the context of economics, a shift in consumer demand means that the buyers, the consumers, are changing their collective balance.
They're changing what they want.
Right. 10 years ago, the collective consumer might have demanded the cheapest, largest tomato possible, regardless of how it was grown.
Just give me a giant tomato for 50 cents.
Exactly. But today, there has been a shift. That same collective consumer might now be demanding a tomato that was grown without chemicals, even if it costs more and is slightly smaller.
And because consumers are the ones holding the money, the farmers literally have no choice but to follow that shift. If people want something different, the entire agricultural economy has to adapt to provide it.
Precisely. The market responds to the money. And this brings us to the first major development the text explores. How is the industry responding? How is technology changing the way we grow food?
Right.
The passage introduces us to something called precision farming.
Okay, so the text says, precision farming utilizes satellite imagery to analyze soil and weather conditions, enhancing crop yields. Now, hold on, I need to play devil's advocate here for a second, because when I read that sentence, my brain immediately trips over the concept.
How so?
Well, I'm picturing a farmer standing in a dusty field of corn in the American Midwest, and somehow, a satellite floating thousands of miles away in the vacuum of space is helping them water their plants.
Wait, satellites? It sounds like sci-fi, I know.
Yeah. How exactly does a camera floating in space tell a farmer when to water a plant down on Earth? Are they just looking at Google Earth photos of their farm?
That is the exact misconception most people have when they hear satellite imagery. You naturally think of a photograph like a visual snapshot.
Right.
But in precision agriculture, imagery means something much deeper. These satellites are not just taking pictures with a regular camera lens. They are equipped with multispectral and hyperspectral sensors.
Multispectral, so they're seeing more than we can.
Exactly. They are reading wavelengths of light that the human eye cannot even perceive, like infrared.
Oh, wow. So they aren't taking photos. They're collecting invisible data.
Yes. It is a data map, not a photograph. For example, healthy, well-watered plants reflect near-infrared light very differently than stressed, thirsty plants.
That makes sense.
So a satellite can pass over a 1,000-acre farm and detect the exact moisture levels in the soil, the minute temperature variations across different elevations, and even the chlorophyll content inside the leaves of the crops.
Okay, that completely changes the picture. So the farmer wakes up, opens a laptop or a tablet, and instead of just looking out the window to see if the dirt looks dry, they download a highly detailed spreadsheet and like a color-coded map of their land.
Yes, exactly. And the map might tell them, hey, the northwest corner of your field has a moisture level of 40%, which is ideal, but the southeast corner has dropped to 15%.
So in the past, the farmer would have just turned on the massive irrigation sprinklers for the entire 1,000 acres.
Right, wasting thousands of gallons of fresh water and hundreds of dollars of electricity just to pump that water to plants that didn't even need it.
But with this data...
With this data, they only turn on the sprinklers for the southeast corner. They give the plants exactly what they need, exactly where they need it, and exactly when they need it. The text refers to this as making informed decisions.
That makes the name precision farming incredibly logical.
Yeah.
Let's do a deep dive into that word precision, because understanding its structure really unlocks a lot of academic vocabulary for the test.
Let's do it. The word precision carries a sense of absolute exactness. So if we break it down to its roots, we have the prefix pre, which generally means before or in advance.
Right, like predict or prepare.
Exactly. But the core of the word comes from the Latin verb cadere, or the root cis, which means to cut.
To cut. Oh, like scissors, or an incision made by a surgeon.
Yes. When you are precise, you have metaphorically cut away all the extra unnecessary parts.
Wow, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, you have trimmed away the guessing, the estimation, the vague approximations. You are left with only the exact truth. Precision farming cuts away the guesswork. It is exact farming.
And the text explicitly tells us how this exactness is applied. It says, precision farming utilizes satellite imagery. I really want to highlight the word utilize for a moment, because this is a secret weapon for TOEFL writing.
It really is a highly favored C1 verb. Utilize essentially means to use something, but it carries a very specific connotation.
Right, it's not just use.
No, you don't just use it casually. You put it to practical, effective use. You are making the most of its utility.
Exactly. If you're writing a TOEFL essay and you find yourself typing, the farmers use satellites to help them, stop right there. Delete the word use and replace it with utilize.
The farmers utilize satellite data.
Yes. It instantly elevates the academic tone of your sentence. Mm-hmm. It shows the grader that you understand formal, discipline-specific language.
And what is the ultimate goal of utilizing this data? The text says it is done to enhance crop yields. We have two vital words here, enhance and yield.
Well, to enhance simply means to improve the quality, the amount, or the strength of something. Like if you add a pinch of salt to a bowl of soup, you enhance the flavor.
Right, the flavor was already there, but you brought it out. You made it better.
Or if you practice your English listening skills every day, you enhance your TOEFL score.
A very common academic collocation, you know, words that frequently appear together, is enhance performance, or in this context, enhance crop yields. And this brings us to yield.
Yes, yield.
Which is arguably the most important high-frequency vocabulary word in this entire passage.
Let's really unpack yield, because it's kind of a chameleon word. It changes its meaning completely depending on the context, and the TOEFL loves to test words with multiple meanings.
They absolutely do. Let's start with how you might encounter it in everyday life. If you're driving a car and you approach an intersection, you might see a red and white triangular sign that says yield.
Right, yielding to traffic.
Yeah, in traffic, to yield means to give way. It means you must slow down or stop to let another vehicle go first. You are surrendering your right of way to someone else.
You also see this in negotiations or arguments. If two people are debating and one person finally admits that the other person is right, they yield the point. They give in.
They surrender. But when you enter the realms of science, finance, or agriculture, the meaning completely flips.
Yeah.
It no longer means to give up. As a verb in academic texts, yield means to produce or to provide.
So an apple tree yields apples.
Exactly.
The chemical reaction might yield a specific gas. Or a smart financial investment will yield a high profit.
Yes. It is producing a tangible result. And in our source text, it is used as a noun. Crop yields. As a noun, the yield is the actual measurable amount of an agricultural product. It is a metric of production.
So it's the actual number.
Right. For example, a farmer might measure their yield as 150 bushels of corn per acre. That number is the yield.
So let's tie this all back together. When the text says precision farming enhances crop yields, it means that by utilizing exact satellite data to only water and fertilize the precise spots that need it, the farmer is able to grow significantly more food on the exact same plot of land.
Exactly. Their production goes up, the yield is enhanced.
And because they're cutting away the waste, not wasting water, not wasting fuel, driving the tractor over parts of the field that don't need it, they are achieving incredible efficiency. They're getting maximum output for minimum input.
Economically, this is the ultimate goal.
But this introduces a massive contradiction in the text, which I find fascinating. Technology is pushing agriculture in this highly scientific, hyper-efficient, data-driven direction.
Yeah.
Satellites in space are dictating how we treat the soil.
Yes.
And yet, the text points out that there is a second major development happening at the exact same time, moving in the exact opposite direction.
Yeah, the text pivots to introduce the organic movement. It states, another development is the rise of organic farming, which responds to consumer preference for sustainable products.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is the irony I'm talking about. To move forward economically, to capture a highly profitable market, a large segment of the agricultural industry is basically looking backward.
Going back to basics.
Yeah. They are abandoning the high-tech chemical advancements of the 20th century and adopting older, more natural methods.
They're doing it because, as we discussed earlier, the consumer demand has shifted. Consumers are increasingly wary of what goes into their food and how their food impacts the planet. The text defines the boundaries of this movement clearly. It says, organic farming avoids synthetic pesticides and fertilizers.
Let's break those terms down, starting with synthetic. This is a crucial word for any TOEFL science passage.
Absolutely. Synthetic is the direct opposite of natural. It refers to a substance that is human-made, artificial, typically manufactured through chemical synthesis in a laboratory or a factory.
You can think of it in terms of clothing, right? Cotton and wool are natural fibers that grow on plants or animals.
Exactly.
But polyester or nylon are synthetic fibers. They are created by chemists. So in farming, a synthetic chemical is one that was cooked up in a lab, not found in nature. And the text mentions two specific synthetic chemicals that organic farmers refuse to use, pesticides and fertilizers.
Let's analyze pesticide. If you know your word roots, you can often decode the meaning of unfamiliar words on the test. The first part of the word is pest. A pest is any destructive insect, animal, or even a disease that attacks crops, food, or livestock.
A locust swarm that eats a field of wheat is a pest. Or a mouse in your kitchen is a pest.
Or fungal rot on a tomato is a pest. And the suffix -ericide comes directly from Latin, meaning to kill or the act of killing.
You see this suffix everywhere in English.
Ah.
Homicide is the killing of a human. Herbicide is the killing of plants or weeds.
So a pesticide is simply a synthetic chemical engineered to kill pests. You spray it on the crop, and any bug that tries to eat the leaves dies. It protects the yield.
Okay, and what about a fertilizer?
The root here is fertile. If soil is fertile, it is rich in nutrients and capable of producing abundant vegetation. Things grow incredibly well in fertile soil. So a fertilizer is a substance that you add to the soil to force it to be more fertile.
Just dumping nutrients into the dirt.
Right. In conventional farming, these are usually synthetic chemicals heavy in concentrated nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium that act like a massive energy drink for the plants, forcing them to grow faster and larger.
Okay, this is where I need to ask a practical question. Conventional farming relies on these lab-made chemicals to kill bugs and force plants to grow. The text says organic farming explicitly avoids them.
They do.
So how do organic farmers grow anything at all? Like, if you refuse to spray a pesticide, won't a swarm of aphids just devour your entire field of lettuce?
It's a huge risk.
And if you refuse to use synthetic fertilizer, won't the soil eventually run out of nutrients and turn to dust?
That is the central, grueling challenge of organic agriculture. It requires replacing chemical shortcuts with complex biological management.
Biological management.
Yes. The text provides the three primary strategies that organic farmers utilize to survive without chemicals: crop rotation, composting, and biological pest control.
Let's unpack the mechanisms behind each of these, because they are brilliant examples of agricultural economics in practice. Let's start with crop rotation.
Sure. So to rotate means to move in a circle or to take turns in a specific order. Crop rotation is the ancient practice of planting different types of crops in the exact same physical area across different seasons or different years.
Why is that necessary, though? Let's look at the biology. Imagine you have a massive field and you decide to plant corn. Corn is notoriously hungry, right?
Very hungry.
As it grows, it rapidly pulls massive amounts of nitrogen out of the soil. If you harvest that corn, and then the very next year you plant corn in that exact same dirt again,
yeah,
it's going to suck out whatever nitrogen is left.
Exactly.
If you do this for 5 years straight, the soil is basically dead. Mm-hmm. It is economically exhausted. It has no nutrients left to give.
And in conventional farming, the solution to dead soil is easy. You just dump tons of synthetic chemical nitrogen fertilizer onto the dirt to artificially bring it back to life.
But the organic farmer can't do that.
Right, they can't. So they rotate. In year one, they plant the hungry corn. But in year two, they plant a legume, like soybeans or peas.
And what's special about soybeans?
Soybeans have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria in their roots that literally pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere and lock it back into the soil.
Oh, wow.
So while the corn takes nitrogen, the soybeans give it back. By rotating the crops, taking turns, the farmer uses biology to keep the soil naturally fertile year after year.
It's like eating a balanced diet. If you only eat spinach for a month, you'll get plenty of iron, but you'll become terribly deficient in protein and fat.
Yeah.
Your body needs a rotation of nutrients. The soil operates the exact same way.
Exactly.
Okay, so that solves the soil exhaustion problem.
Right.
What about the second strategy, composting?
Composting is the ultimate form of natural recycling. Instead of buying chemical fertilizer from a factory, an organic farmer takes decaying organic material, things like leftover crop stalks, animal manure, leaves, food waste, and piles it up.
Just a big pile of organic waste.
Yeah, and over time, microorganisms, bacteria, and worms break that waste down into a dark, incredibly nutrient-dense substance called compost. When you spread compost on a field, you are feeding the soil with the broken-down remnants of previous life.
It's essentially mimicking what happens on a forest floor when leaves fall and rot into dirt, just sped up and managed by the farmer.
Right, exactly.
And we still have the bug problem.
Right.
If you have a beautiful field of organic soybeans and a swarm of destructive insects arrives, you can't spray synthetic pesticides. The text says the solution is biological pest control.
The word biological means relating to biology or living organisms. So biological pest control is the strategy of using living creatures to fight other living creatures. It is using nature as a weapon against nature.
Do we have a real-world example of this? Like, how does that actually look?
Oh, the most famous example involves aphids. Aphids are tiny, soft-bodied insects that act like vampires on plants. They suck the sap right out of the leaves and can decimate a crop.
They're a huge pest.
They are. And if an organic farmer spots an aphid infestation, instead of reaching for a chemical spray, they might purchase thousands of ladybugs.
Wait, really? Ladybugs? Like the little red beetles with black spots?
Exactly. To us, ladybugs look cute. But to an aphid, a ladybug is an apex predator.
A tiny little apex predator.
Exactly. A single ladybug can eat up to 50 aphids a day. So the farmer releases the ladybugs into the field. The ladybugs hunt down and eat the pests. The crop is saved. The environment is free of poison. And the farmer maintains their organic certification.
That is incredible. But implementing all of these biological systems, managing rotations, making compost, buying predator insects, it takes significantly more time, more labor, and more knowledge than just spraying a chemical. Why go through the hassle?
Well, the text highlights two major outcomes. First, it brings environmental benefits, which is pretty obvious. You aren't polluting local rivers with chemical runoff. But second, it says it creates niche markets for farmers. We really need to master two vital vocabulary words here. Why does this market exist? The text says it's because consumers have a preference for sustainable products.
Oh, sustainable. Yeah. That is a buzzword you will see in almost every single TOEFL reading or listening section related to the environment, business, or urban planning. It is inescapable.
Let's dissect it. The root comes from the Latin sustenere, which means to hold up, to support, or to endure. When we add the suffix able, meaning capable of, we get a word that essentially means capable of enduring.
Capable of lasting a long time.
Yes. In modern academic and economic contexts, sustainable describes a method of harvesting or using a resource so that the resource is not depleted or permanently damaged.
So if a farming practice is sustainable, it means we can continue doing it for 100 years or 500 years, and the earth will still be healthy enough to produce food.
By contrast, if a practice is unsustainable, it means it might work wonderfully today and it might make you rich tomorrow, but in 20 years, the soil will be dead rock and the water will be toxic. It cannot endure.
A growing segment of the population understands this, and they want to support the long-term health of the planet. So they specifically seek out and purchase sustainable products. And this desire creates what the text identifies as a niche market.
Niche. This is a tricky word. You might hear people pronounce it niche, which is closer to the French origin, or niche, which is more anglicized.
Both are entirely acceptable, though niche tends to sound a bit more formal in international business contexts.
Regardless of how you pronounce it, the meaning is vital. A niche is a very specific, specialized, and often small segment of the broader market.
Let's visualize this. The broad market is everyone who eats apples. Most people in the broad market just want a cheap apple. They really don't care how it was grown. But within that massive group, there's a smaller subset of people who are deeply passionate about the environment, who refuse to eat synthetic chemicals, and who are willing to pay double or triple the price for an apple that aligns with their values. That small, dedicated group is a niche.
And for an agricultural economist, capturing a niche market can be highly lucrative. The organic farmer might have a lower overall yield than the conventional farmer next door, but because they are selling to a niche market that pays a premium price, they can still run a highly profitable business.
So we've looked at the micro level, we've looked at the satellites in the sky and the ladybugs in the dirt. We understand how the food is grown, but An apple doesn't just sit in the orchard forever. Where does it go?
This is where the text dramatically shifts its scope. It pulls the camera all the way back to view the entire planet. We enter section 4 of the underlying structure, the web of global trade.
The text states, global trade also impacts agricultural economics. Nations depend on importing and exporting food to meet domestic needs and take advantage of international prices.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where agricultural economics truly becomes global economics. Before we dive into the mechanics of this, we need to secure the foundational vocabulary. We had a classic TOEFL contrast here, domestic versus international.
This contrast is foundational to understanding geopolitics and macroeconomics. Domestic relates to activities, events, or policies that occur inside your own home country. Think of the Latin root domus, meaning home.
Right, like a domestic flight.
Exactly. If you take a domestic flight, you are taking off and landing within the borders of your own country. A domestic policy is a law that only affects citizens at home.
In our text, domestic needs refers to the literal food requirements of the people living inside that specific nation. A country has a domestic need to feed its own population.
But the contrasting word is international. The prefix inter means between or among. National refers to nations. So international means existing or occurring between two or more different nations.
Nations engage in international trade, they import, which means bringing goods in from abroad, and they export, which means sending goods out for sale.
Why do they do this, though?
The text gives two reasons. First, to meet those domestic needs. If your country is mostly desert, you physically cannot grow enough wheat to feed your citizens. You are forced to import it.
That makes perfect sense.
But the second reason is purely economic. To take advantage of international prices. Let's say you are a farmer in a country that produces massive amounts of avocados. You have more avocados than your domestic market can possibly eat.
Just a mountain of avocados.
Yes. If you try to sell them all at home, the oversupply will drive the price down to pennies. You'll go bankrupt. But if you look at the international market, you might see that consumers in Europe are willing to pay $5 for a single avocado.
Oh, wow.
So you export your crop. You take advantage of the international price disparity to maximize your profit.
This creates a wildly complex system.
Yeah.
I always picture global supply chains like a massive, intricate spider web, or perhaps a giant planetary game of dominoes. If you pluck one string or knock over one piece, it's felt everywhere.
Let's trace a physical example of a global supply chain to illustrate just how interconnected this domino game really is. Let's look at something as simple as a loaf of bread sold in a supermarket in Mexico City.
Okay, a loaf of bread. Seems simple enough.
Where did it come from? Well, the wheat for that bread might have been grown on a massive precision tech farm in the plains of Canada.
Okay.
That Canadian farm utilized tractors that were manufactured in Germany. The tractors ran on diesel fuel imported from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Once the Canadian wheat is harvested, it is loaded onto a train and exported to the United States.
That's already four countries.
Right. In the U.S., a massive industrial facility mills that wheat into fine flour. Then that flour is loaded onto trucks and exported south across the border into Mexico. There, a commercial bakery mixes the U.S. milled flour with sugar imported from Brazil to bake the bread. Finally, local trucks deliver it to the grocery store in Mexico City.
So that single slice of bread contains the labor, the resources, and the economic policies of Canada, Germany, the Middle East, the United States, Brazil, and Mexico. That is a staggering level of connection.
And that connection is exactly what the text issues a severe warning about. The passage states, however, this interdependency can lead to economic vulnerability when global supply chains are disrupted by political instability or natural disasters.
There are three incredibly powerful, high-level vocabulary words embedded in that warning. Interdependency, vulnerability, and disrupted. If you want to score high on the TOEFL, you must understand the nuance of these terms. Let's do a deep dive, starting with interdependency.
We already looked at the prefix inter, meaning between or among. The root word is dependency, which means the state of relying on or needing someone or something else for aid, support, or survival. Like a newborn baby has a total dependency on its parents.
So when we combine them into interdependency, it implies a mutual reciprocal reliance. Two or more entities are relying on each other.
In our bread example, the bakery in Mexico is dependent on the U.S. flour mill. But the U.S. flour mill is dependent on the Canadian wheat farmer. And the Canadian wheat farmer is economically dependent on the Mexican bakery buying the final product so that the farmer can afford to plant seeds next year.
They're locked together. If one fails, they all suffer.
Exactly. And because they're all holding hands, because they're locked in this mutual reliance, it creates a state of what the text calls vulnerability.
Vulnerability is the state of being exposed to the possibility of being attacked, harmed, or damaged, either physically, emotionally, or in this case, economically. If a medieval castle leaves its main gate wide open, it has a physical vulnerability. It is open to attack.
If you invest all your life savings into a single, highly risky tech stock, you have extreme economic vulnerability. If that one company fails, you lose everything. You are exposed to harm.
The text argues that the global supply chain, because of its interdependency, is highly vulnerable. It is exposed to risk. And what is the specific risk? The risk is that the supply chain might be disrupted.
Disrupted. This is a fantastic word to dissect. The root is rupt, which comes from Latin, meaning to break or to burst. You will encounter this root constantly in English vocabulary.
Right. Think of a volcano. When the pressure builds up and the magma breaks through the surface, it erupts.
If you are having a conversation and someone suddenly speaks over you, breaking the flow of your words, they interrupt you.
Or if a company runs out of money and its financial structure breaks, it goes bankrupt.
And the prefix dis often implies apart or away. So to disrupt means to break something apart, to drastically alter or destroy the structure of a process or system. It is causing a severe disturbance that stops normal operations.
Let's apply this to our domino analogy of the global supply chain. Imagine that an unexpected massive drought, a natural disaster, hits the plains of Canada. The wheat crop fails entirely. The harvest yields almost nothing.
That is the disruption. The chain is broken right at the very first link.
Exactly. Because of that broken link, the train in Canada has nothing to carry. The massive flour mill in the United States suddenly has zero raw material to process, so they have to lay off their factory workers.
And the commercial bakery in Mexico can't get any flour, so they can't bake any bread.
And suddenly the consumer in Mexico City walks into the grocery store and finds empty shelves, or discovers that the price of a single loaf of bread has quadrupled overnight.
The drought happened 3,000 miles away, but because of interdependency, the economic pain is felt globally. The text points out that these disruptions aren't just caused by natural disasters like droughts or floods. They can also be caused by political instability.
Like what?
Political instability could mean a sudden war breaking out, blocking shipping lanes. It could mean a government abruptly deciding to place massive tariffs or taxes on imports, making trade too expensive.
Oh, I see.
Or it could be a nation simply closing its borders and refusing to export its food because it is afraid of a domestic shortage. The moment politics interferes with the flow of goods, the supply chain is disrupted and the vulnerability of the whole system is exposed.
It really highlights how fragile this entire global structure is. We like to think of modern economics as a solid, unbreakable machine, but it's actually incredibly delicate. And that fragility transitions us perfectly into the final segment of our deep dive.
This is where the source text provides a reality check. A classic feature of high-level academic writing is the critical analysis phase. Mm-hmm. A strong writer doesn't just present the benefits of a new system, they critically examine the flaws. The final paragraph of our text is dedicated entirely to exploring the stark challenges and downsides of precision farming, organic farming, and global trade.
This is where I want to push back again and really interrogate the text.
Yeah.
We've spent the last half hour talking about how amazing these advancements are.
We have.
So if precision farming is hyper-efficient and maximizes crop yields, and if organic farming heals the soil, protects the environment, and captures highly profitable niche markets, why aren't all farmers doing both of these things 100% of the time? Why is this even a debate?
Because in economics, nothing exists in a vacuum. Every choice has a cost. The text breaks down the very practical, often insurmountable barriers to these innovations. Let's look at precision farming first.
Okay.
The text states, precision farming requires significant investment in technology, which can be prohibitive for small-scale farmers.
Right. We talked about multispectral satellites, infrared beta analysis, and computer-controlled irrigation systems. That level of hardware and software is not cheap.
It requires immense capital, and the key vocabulary word the author uses to describe this cost is prohibitive.
Prohibitive. This is an excellent C1 adjective.
Yeah.
It connects directly to the verb prohibit, which means to formally forbid by law, rule, or other authority. A sign on a door might say, smoking is prohibited. It is forbidden. You are not allowed to do it.
But when we use it as an adjective to describe a price or a cost, a prohibitive cost, it takes on an economic nuance. It doesn't mean there is a law against buying the technology.
Right. Nobody's arresting you for buying it.
Exactly. It means the price is so outrageously high that it practically prevents you from buying it. The cost itself acts as a barrier that forbids you from participating.
It prices you out of the market. Let's make this concrete. Imagine a massive corporate farm that owns 50,000 acres of land and has millions of dollars in the bank. They can easily afford the satellite data subscriptions. They buy the tech, their yields skyrocket, and their profits multiply.
Makes sense for them.
But what about the small, family-owned farm down the road? They only own 200 acres. They barely make enough profit to fix their tractor. If the new precision technology costs $300,000, that cost is prohibitive for them.
They simply cannot afford it. This raises an important question. How do nations write laws that protect small farmers who can't afford expensive satellites? Because this leads to a dangerous economic disparity.
Yeah, the big guys win.
The large corporate farms get more and more efficient, driving the price of food down, while the small family farmer is stuck using old, inefficient methods. Eventually, the small farmer can't compete with the low prices of the corporate farm, and they go bankrupt. So while precision technology is a massive advancement for total production, it arguably accelerates the death of the small-scale farmer.
That is a harsh reality. Okay, what about organic farming? The environmental benefits are clear. The soil stays healthy. The water stays clean. What is the downside?
The text states, organic farming often yields lower outputs than conventional methods, complicating the balance between sustainability and food security.
This single sentence encapsulates arguably the greatest tension in modern agricultural economics.
It really does. We discussed earlier how organic farming relies on biological processes, crop rotation, compost, ladybugs, rather than synthetic chemicals. But the biological reality is that without the massive artificial energy boost of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, plants simply do not grow as rapidly or as densely. And without the total annihilation of insects provided by synthetic pesticides, some portion of the crop is inevitably going to be eaten by pests or lost to disease.
So, as the text explicitly notes, organic farming yields lower outputs. The sheer volume of food produced per acre is lower. You might get beautiful natural apples, but you're going to get fewer of them.
And this lower yield triggers a massive ethical and economic conflict between two vital human goals, sustainability and food security.
We have thoroughly defined sustainability. The ability to maintain the health of the Earth's resources for future generations. We want the soil to endure. But what exactly is meant by food security in a global context?
Food security is the state of having reliable access to a sufficient quantity of affordable, nutritious food. On a macro level, it is the mathematical equation of human survival. We have roughly 8 billion human beings currently living on the planet. We project that number will hit nearly 10 billion by the year 2050.
That is staggering.
Food security means ensuring that the total global yield of agriculture is high enough to put enough calories onto the plates of 10 billion people so that they don't starve.
I see the complication. It's a terrifying math problem. Organic farming is incredible for sustainability. It protects the soil for the next century. But because it yields lower outputs, it threatens immediate food security.
Exactly. If we passed a global law tomorrow, banning all synthetic chemicals and forcing every farm on Earth to switch to 100% organic methods, the total global food supply would plummet.
Oh, wow.
We might suddenly find ourselves with a massive caloric deficit. We wouldn't have enough total volume of food to feed everyone. Millions of people, particularly in poorer developing nations, would face famine.
So we are trapped in a balancing act. How much chemical damage are we willing to inflict on the environment in order to guarantee that we produce enough sheer volume to feed 8 billion people today? Or, conversely, how much of a yield reduction are we willing to accept, and who will go hungry because of it in order to save the ecosystem for tomorrow?
It is the ultimate dilemma of agricultural economics. There is no easy answer, which is why it remains such a hotly debated topic. And finally, the text addresses the challenges inherent in global trade. We have already explored the vulnerability of interdependent supply chains to disruption. The text concludes by adding, reliance on global trade exposes countries to fluctuations in international markets, necessitating robust economic policies to manage these risks.
The author leads us with two excellent high-level vocabulary words to finish our analysis, fluctuations and robust. Let's look at fluctuations first.
The root of fluctuation is fluor, which is Latin for to flow. Think of the word fluid. Water in an ocean or a river doesn't stay perfectly flat and static. It has waves. It rises with the tide. It falls. It churns. It flows back and forth.
And that dynamic movement is exactly what a fluctuation is. It is an irregular rising and falling in number, amount, or level. It is a continuous variation.
In economics, prices rarely stay still. They fluctuate. If you look at the international price of wheat over a single month, you will see a jagged line on a graph. It goes up on Tuesday because there was a rumor of a drought in Australia. It goes down on Thursday because Russia announces a massive harvest.
It surges up on Friday because the cost of diesel fuel for the shipping freighters increased.
Ew.
The price is constantly waving up and down based on a million different variables.
And if your country is heavily reliant on importing its food, if you are highly interdependent, you are totally exposed to these wild price fluctuations. If the global price of wheat suddenly triples because of a war on another continent, your citizens might suddenly be unable to afford to buy bread.
Which is why the text argues that nations need robust economic policies to manage these risks.
Right.
Robust. I absolutely love the texture of this word.
It is a fantastic, highly descriptive adjective. It conveys a specific kind of strength. How would you describe it?
To me, it means strong, healthy, vigorous, and deeply resilient. It actually shares a distant etymological connection with the Latin word robustus, which originally referred to an oak tree.
An oak tree, yes.
Think about an oak tree. It has deep, thick roots. It has a massive, solid trunk. When a severe storm hits, a weak, thin tree will snap in half. But the oak tree is robust. It stands firm. It endures the wind. It doesn't break easily.
You can use it in many contexts. A person might have a robust immune system, meaning they rarely get sick. Their body fights off infections easily. A software program might be described as robust if it doesn't crash easily and can handle massive amounts of data without freezing.
You can even have a robust flavor in a dark roast coffee or a complex wine. Mm-hmm. It means the flavor is strong, full-bodied, and powerful.
But here, the text uses a very specific common academic collocation, robust economic policies.
If a nation knows that the global food market is volatile, unpredictable, and prone to wild fluctuations and disruptions, they cannot rely on weak, simple, or fragile laws. They need policies that are like that oak tree. They need strong, detailed, adaptable, and deeply resilient strategies, robust policies.
What does a robust economic policy look like in the real world of agriculture?
Right. How do you actually do that?
It might mean a government establishing strategic grain reserves, basically, building massive silos and storing millions of tons of emergency wheat so that if the global supply chain breaks down, they have a backup plan to feed their people. It might mean offering financial subsidies to domestic farmers, guaranteeing them a minimum price for their crops so they don't go bankrupt during a bad year. It means having layers of protection.
Layers of protection against a highly volatile world. We have covered a truly tremendous amount of ground today. We have moved from invisible infrared data collected by satellites in orbit down to the nitrogen-fixing bacteria in the roots of a soybean plant and then zoomed all the way out to trace the fragile web of international trade spanning the globe.
And we have navigated the deep tensions between maximizing efficiency, ensuring environmental survival, and feeding a rapidly expanding human population.
Before we sign off, I want to pull all of this together. We aren't going to do a rapid-fire dictionary review. You can read a dictionary on your own time. Instead, I want you to visualize a scenario that connects every major C1 concept we discussed today into a single narrative.
Application is the key to retention. Let's build the scenario.
Imagine you are a farmer. You are standing in the middle of your field. Your goal, economically, is to produce as much food as possible. You want a massive yield. For decades, your family achieved this by spraying synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. It worked, but you've noticed the dirt is turning to dust. The practice is no longer sustainable. The land is dying.
So you decide to shift your methods. You want to capture the profitable niche market of organic buyers. You stop using chemicals. You start rotating crops and buying ladybugs. But almost immediately, your yields drop. You are producing less food.
To fix the lower yield, you look into buying advanced satellite imagery to practice precision farming. You want to eliminate waste. But when you look at the price tag for the software, you realize the cost is prohibitive. You, as a small family farmer, simply cannot afford it.
Meanwhile, the bank is demanding payment for your mortgage. You are trapped by your interdependency with the global market. A drought in a country 5,000 miles away has caused massive fluctuations in the price of your crop. The price drops unexpectedly.
You realize that to survive in this industry, you need your local government to step in with robust economic policies to protect you from being crushed by the volatile, easily disrupted global supply chain.
That narrative contains the entire essence of the source text. When you can see the vocabulary operating dynamically within a real-world scenario, you move from merely translating English to actually thinking in English.
The next time you are walking down the aisles of your local grocery store, I challenge you. Don't just put things into your cart on autopilot. Stop. Look at the organic labels. Look at the tiny stickers on the fruit that tell you which country it was imported from.
Just think about the journey.
Right. Realize that you are standing at the very terminal end of a massive, fragile, technologically advanced web. Think about the satellite that might have determined how much water that corn received. Think about the predator insects that protected those organic apples. When you connect TOEFL vocabulary to your actual everyday life, it stops being a test and it starts being a lens through which you understand the mechanics of the world.
It changes your perspective entirely. And as a final thought to mull over, building on the tensions we've discussed today, as climate change continues to accelerate, making global weather patterns more extreme, more violent, and more unpredictable, will we reach a point where we are forced to rely entirely on incredibly expensive precision technology just to coax basic crops out of the ground?
That is a terrifying prospect.
It is. And if that happens, if farming requires millions of dollars of proprietary tech just to survive the erratic weather, what happens to the natural, low-tech methods? Will the niche market of organic, naturally grown food become an extreme luxury? Will a simple natural apple grown without a satellite's permission become a status symbol that only the ultra-rich can afford to eat?
That is exactly the kind of profound critical thinking that the TOEFL rewards, and an incredible question to leave you with today. This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio.
Thanks for joining us.
Until next time, keep upgrading your English.